Dear Ajahn, when it comes to letting go, how do you ask people who think you owe them a duty to make them happy to let you go? This would mainly be a close relative, since one can more easily tell an outsider to go away. How does one apply loving kindness to solve this? How to find enough loving kindness to do it? So, somebody else thinks you owe them a duty to make them happy. I don't know where that really comes from. You know, sometimes kids think their parents have a duty to make them happy and look after them up to a certain time. But remember, I always compare human beings to birds. We're supposed to be a higher level of being. When it comes to raising children, you cannot beat the birds. Because the birds will look after the kids. They will sit on the eggs, first of all. And if ever you've got a sore bottom sitting meditation, think of those poor birds. Hour after hour after hour. And as soon as those chicks are hatched, they feed and feed and feed them all day. And they always want more food. It's not like your kids. Sometimes they sleep, sometimes they've had enough. But birds, they've got their beak open, always asking for more. And then the birds teach their young how to fly. Now, when I did my 6-month solitary retreat, I used to watch a pair of eagles who were nesting, and you saw them take their kid, their baby, out for the first flight, which was really, really cute to watch that. Now, when you're on retreat for 6 months, you can actually watch nature become so sensitive and see a pair of eagles raise their young. And after that, once the bird can fly, what do mum and dad do? They're off! They kick the bird out of the nest. The son and daughter, they just go. You're out of here, mate. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful if parents could do that? Because all you owe them is, you know, just bringing them up, looking after them, caring for them. But the point is that I like to impress upon parents, they're not your kids. These are beings who come into your life. Where they come from, you don't know. From what previous birth or previous realm. And now they're here in your life. And you look after them, care for them. And you really sacrifice a lot. You get a lot of fun out of that. But you always know that they're not yours. Later on, they will go into their own careers, their own life, go and get married, live in another country. And it's bye-bye, children. And that's as it should be. So your job is never to think that they are your children. That's the problem. They're just children. You look after them for a while and then you let them go. So you don't owe them past giving them an education and getting them started. And please don't leave your inheritance to your kids. Because it's such a stupid thing to do because the kids get very lazy. Maybe you can give them a bit of a start, but don't give them too much. If you give them too much, then they will never appreciate anything. And they usually waste it. So just give them enough to get going. And then, okay, off you go. So, and if it's like your partner in life, remember what I always said, I mentioned this earlier, when I do any marriage ceremony, I always look at one person, then the other person, then to say that in a marriage, in a relationship, you should never think of yourself, nor should you think of the partner, it's all about us. So if it's a case that you think of yourself and the partner as being different, then of course there is duties of owing. I helped you, now you have to help me back. When it's us, your duty is to the partnership, not to one person. It's to us. Not me, not him, not her. And that makes it a lot different. But if you owe them a duty to make them happy, to let you go. You know, after a while, that you cannot own anybody. You can't own your children. You can't own your parents. You have to let them go sooner or later. And as I've often said, that's the greatest act of love, is to let somebody go. Remember, we had a wonderful time together. Now's the time you go to Singapore, I go somewhere else. We spent 9 days together. Bye-bye. And that's as it should be. We let each other go. We have no more duties than that. When we know what our duties are in life, and then it's one of the duties is to let go of things. And you don't owe anything. For example, that sometimes people are very grateful for the teachings and example which I have done and given you. And sometimes people say, well, I owe you, Ajahn Brahm. And I always remember Ajahn Chah teaching me, because he helped me so much, and I asked him, how can I ever repay your the debt I have to you? And he said, you can never repay the debt which you owe me, except by helping others. So you don't pay it back, you pay it on. So if I've helped you, the only way to pay off what you owe me is to give all these teachings and kindness to somebody else. That's why teaching you and teaching people in Malaysia and Australia and all over the world, it's the way I'm paying off my debt to Ajahn Chah. He helped me, so I help you. Now you're in debt to me. Now you've got to go and help somebody else. And then you paid off your debt to your teacher. That's how owing and letting go happens. It's quite beautiful. Let's see what else we've got here. Sorry to ask you to repeat. Please elaborate the donkey and the two juries relating to listless. Thank you very much. There was only one jury, and sometimes people are so greedy they want to an extra one. So the old story, donkey, Durian, stick on the donkey's back, string on the end of a stick, Durian on the end of the string. So when the donkey goes after the Durian is always in front of the donkey's mouth and can never catch it. That's why we're always running somewhere. That's what listlessness is. We're always running somewhere, always going somewhere, always doing something. And we think that by going here, going there, we're going to catch something. Get the joy, get satisfaction, happiness, or whatever else you're after in life. And you find that's the whole meaning of your life is always running after something. And you can never catch it. You get close many times. But it's always in front of you, it's within reach. But when you go towards it, it disappears. Do you remember when you were children and you saw a rainbow? And you could see where the rainbow was striking the ground, maybe in some field or garden somewhere. You went over to the end of the rainbow, and as soon as you approached where the rainbow met the ground, the rainbow moved away from you. You can never catch the foot of the rainbow. In Western culture, they always said it was a pot of gold at that end of a rainbow. But of course, you know, you can never catch it. When you go towards it, it moves away from you. And that's like so many things in life. That's the durian in front of the donkey. But you find a way of catching that durian. You just stop. You let go. Now, I've told many people in their interviews, don't try to let go. You let go of trying. And this, no, it's not a funny, it's not a smart aleck statement. It's actually very deep. Don't try to let go. Let go of trying, which means you stop. And then the durian comes towards you. So that's how you stop listlessness. Because listlessness, restlessness, is always wanting something and thinking that moving, scratching will get rid of the itch. But it never does. So after a while, you just stop. And then everything which all that movement promised you comes to you, rather than you chasing it. I used to tell the monks one of my stories that when I was a young monk in Thailand, it was very tough, not only with food, but you'd hardly ever see any tea or coffee or anything like that, except when when you were dyeing your robes. Because to make dye, you had to work maybe 24, 36 hours. So it was acceptable. If you were dyeing a robe, you can have some tea and coffee in the dyeing shed as much as you like, because you've got to keep up all night. And one day, some of my friends, they were in the dyeing shed dyeing their robes all night. And I happened to wake up a little bit early. The bell went at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was up about 2:45, and I thought, if I go to the dyeing shed, I'm sure my friends will give me a cup of tea or coffee. I'm up early enough, there'd be some there, and it would help me with my morning meditation. I'd have good meditation that morning. And I thought, no, that's just following your craving. That's not the sort of thing a monk, good monk should do. And before I knew it, I was off walking towards the dyeing shed. I just couldn't resist. And when I got to, halfway towards the dyeing shed, I heard the 3 o'clock bell ring. And that was important to notice. And when I got to the shed a couple of minutes later, it was cleaned up, they'd finished. They'd finished early. And so no monks were there, no tea, no coffee, but it was all still warm. And I thought, oh well, never mind. So I went into the hall and did my meditation, which was quite sleepy. And after the meditation was finished, those monks, they came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, where were you at 3 a.m? I said, I was out walking along that path. Oh, we came the other path to bring you a cup of tea. They were so kind, and I was kind to them. They made a cup of tea for me, and were going to give it to me as I woke up in the early morning. If I had only resisted my craving and defilement, the tea would have come to me. And that's happened to me so often in life. When I've gone chasing things, I never get it. When I've just sat here, it comes to me. It's weird, but it's so true. So that's the story of the donkey and the carrot, and very much on life. You sit down and things happen. You chase them, and you just make more misery for yourself. Anyway, this is the vegetarian thing. Doesn't Buddhism teach us not to kill living creatures? How do Buddhists then defend non-vegetarianism? I was on the retreat in June, and when you said it was okay so long as you don't personally do the killing, isn't that like saying it's okay to murder someone so long as you don't do it personally, but hire a hitman? Continuing to eat meat supports the meat industry where people kill animals for food and indulge in inhumane practices for profit. This is actually what the Buddha said. You can't order something to be killed. Now, if someone offers you it without you asking for it, then that is acceptable according to Buddhism. And I've already mentioned that first couple of years in Thailand as a young monk, the food was disgusting. But one day this Thai woman who'd married an American man came to visit our monastery. And it turned out this American man had a turkey farm. And it was about 3 or 4 days before Christmas. And he said to us, he said, oh, you don't eat very much, you're all really thin here. And it's Christmas soon, I'm going to give you a turkey for Christmas. And he says, I'm going to choose a nice fat one and give it to you. And we had to say no, because it was killed especially for the monks. We can't accept it. And that really hurt. But it would have hurt the turkey more, so fair enough. But if it's not designed to be killed for you, then the Buddha said, yes, you can eat it. Because sometimes the monks don't have that luxury to choose their food. And anyway, as I mentioned to people, it's a bit cheeky answer, but I like being a bit cheeky sometimes. Have you not heard the saying, you are what you eat? You've heard that before? So a cow eats grass. So a cow is just grass, that's all. So eating a cow is just vegetarian. I was told that the more we meditate, spirits who needed merits may come to request that we give them some merits. How to pass our merits to them when they are already dead? Exactly, they won't come to you. For those of you who get scared of these things, one of the key stories, this is just an example of many. There was a Thai lady who came, she married a Westerner and came to live in Perth many years ago. And she got divorced from her husband, but she had 3 or 4 really good kids. And when she got established, she had a mother, her father had already died. And so she got a visa for her mother to come to Australia to live, so that this Thai girl could look after her mother. So the mother came to stay in Perth. She couldn't speak any English, but I could speak Thai, so we could talk to each other. But one day she got very sick. She was already quite old. So the daughter put her in hospital. And then she came and told me this strange story. She did not know whether her mother was going to survive this illness or not. So she went to one of these spirit doctors, these mediums. It didn't cost that much, only $20 Australian. It was quite a famous medium in Perth. And the medium said, give me the name of the hospital, the ward and the room, and then I can just leave my body, go into an astral body, and I can check on your mum to see whether this is going to be her last illness or whether she will survive. So it was a good deal. She gave the $20 to this medium, and the medium went into a trance. She went unconscious. And about 5-10 minutes later, she came out of trance, and the first thing she did was give the $20 note back to the Thai girl. And the Thai girl said, what are you doing? He said, look, I found the hospital, I found the ward, and I found the room in which your mother was, but I couldn't get inside. He said, this is how the medium described it. There's a force field around your mother. A really incredible force field. I've never seen that before. I couldn't get in. That's why I'm giving the $20 back. I'm sorry, I just can't get in there. Who is your mum? And she said, she's Buddhist nun, keeping 8 precepts for the last 20 years. And when the daughter said that, she was like a Mechi, keeping 8 precepts for such a long time. The medium took the $20 back. You should have told me to begin with. You've been wasting my time. People like me cannot get close to people like that. Now that's one example of many. Spirits or anybody who leaves their body like that, if they do come across a person who's keeping good virtue or meditating, how they see you is this big force field around you. They just can't get close, they can't get in. That's how they see you. And for a monk, they can't even get in the gate. There's this huge force field around. That's how they perceive these things. And I like telling you that because it makes you feel very safe. As long as you're keeping precepts, at least 5 precepts, you're pretty protected from these lower beings. They just can't get at you. But if you break your virtue, and you got some chinks in your armor, then maybe they can get in. But anyone who keeps 5 precepts really well, who's kind, compassionate, especially those who meditate, you don't realize the power you have. Far, far greater than these spirits. So you don't have to worry about them at all. As I said, they're afraid of you. They can't get close. Even another story. There was another medium who used to know, and she once brought an Aboriginal elder to Bodhinyana Monastery. You know, this indigenous who's very spiritual and very sensitive. And she came to see me and chatted a little while about many things. And then afterwards, she told me that the Aboriginal elder is in the car outside the monastery. So why didn't you bring him in? And she said, because as we were going in, the Aboriginal elder said, stop, I can't get in this place. It's too powerful for me. I can't get through the gate. He was that sensitive, he realized how much power is in that place. And I scolded that girl, that medium. I said, look, all you needed to do was to ask my permission. And then he could have got in easily. And this is like, psychic stuff. This is actually how it happens. So you are perfectly, absolutely safe in here. No spirits can come near this place. So anyway, so no worries at all here. Dear Venerable, how can I maintain and improve my mindfulness practice after I leave the Jhana Grove retreat? The best thing to do is don't leave. But just in general, that sometimes it is hard because you're very busy and you don't have the same support as you have here, where everybody is doing the same thing. Everybody is meditating, some a lot, some not so much. And even though that many of you are talking, it's not quite as much talking as you do back home. So at least you've lessened that, which is good. You could do better though. But when you get back home, you just haven't got the support. You haven't got like a monk giving you a talk every morning and every evening and just, you know, talking about Dhamma all the time. So without that support, it's very difficult. Nevertheless, you can still, you know, hang out with other Buddhists, like in a Buddhist fellowship or the BGF or whatever other group you belong to. It's good to associate always with good people because they do uplift you. And to meditate as much as possible. Now it's so easy, you can listen to all these talks, you know, on YouTube, which is a wonderful thing to do. Because that keeps reminding you of what you should be doing. And that supports you. Which means that when you get back home, your mindfulness will never get as strong as it's on a retreat, but it can still be reasonably good to protect and look after your practice. And when there is the next retreat on, join up and come and go, and come on the retreat. It's like you keep the pot warm when you're out there in the workforce, but you can't really bring it to the boil. But when you come on a retreat, you can really get into it and bring it to the boil pretty quickly. And of course, the more you meditate and keep mindfulness going in your workplace, it means when you do come on a retreat, you don't have to start from scratch. You know, you can get into it very quickly because you've been practicing beforehand. So that's how we do things, and it works pretty well. If we are doing present moment awareness, then shouldn't we be paying attention to whatever is happening around us, including all the sounds we hear? At first, yes. So the present moment awareness is whatever is happening right now. And then after the present moment awareness, you just get silent so you don't make a comment about it. You know these people, whatever you think or whatever you read, they've always got a comment about everything. You talk about Buddhism, they've got a comment about Buddhism, even if they're a Christian. You talk about politics, they've got a comment about Obama, even though they've never heard a talk of it. People always want to give comments about things. And isn't it wonderful that there are some people who are just silent? They don't need to comment. And that's a person who knows the beauty of silence. And as the Buddha said, if you don't speak very much, in other words, you're mostly silent, that means that when you do speak, your words are so valuable that people listen to you. If you think in life people don't listen to you, that's because you speak too much. That's why people don't listen to me. Look how much I speak. And that beautiful saying of the Buddha, it is small streams make all the noise. Big rivers flow silently. So you've got a choice what you want to be. A big river or a small little stream. Which makes the most noise? Well, the other thing you've noticed, little dogs make lots of noise. Big dogs are usually quite quiet. So are you a big one or a little one? So when you're in the present moment, that's first of all, then you get silent, and then you start focusing on something like the breath and leaving all the sounds outside. So you get your mindfulness up first of all, with present moment awareness and silence, and then you focus on something like the breath, and at that point, you stop concerning yourself with sounds outside or feelings or other stuff. You're starting to focus on something to simplify the mind. So instead of having so many things to deal with, just one silly, simple thing like the breath going in and going out. Help, sudden feeling of listlessness again, anxiousness, feeling totally lost and losing my sanity. I quickly leave the place, I'm in solitude, in room, house, shower, and go to an open area. Meditate, and what else should I do? I want to get out of. Thank you, get out of this feeling. Thank you. When you want to get out of that feeling, that's what drives you crazy. Be there. Is going crazy against any of the 8 precepts? So I give you permission to go crazy. Be free, be crazy, like Ajahn Brahm. Sadhu, 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 I'm crazy. What I'm saying though is usually if you try and stop these things, that's where the problem comes. Please always remember, I'm saying it again, the monster in the emperor's palace. You're listless, you're anxious, losing your sanity. Welcome insanity. Thank you for coming to visit me. It's been years since I've been here, say. And of course, if you welcome it like that, the sanity returns to you. All insanity is to try and to control things which are beyond your power. Doing things which you just can't do. That's insanity. What sanity is letting things be. It's nothing to do with you, it's not your business, you're only visiting your mind, you don't own it. So who the heck is insane anyway? So that way we don't need to be afraid. It's the fear which creates the problems. I haven't said much about fear, but it's so deeply ingrained in us that we're afraid of so much stuff. We're afraid of going out of our comfort zone, eating food we've never ate before, sleeping in places we've never slept before, or most importantly, going to places in meditation where you've never been before. It's very scary. But you should be like adventurous. Do you remember when you were young, you were really adventurous, you would always be willing to try new things, just for the heck of it? Why have you lost that? Because sometimes we're afraid we'll get hurt. Please, it doesn't really matter. It's more important that we discover new things, especially in meditation. Be courageous. Be adventurous. Because those sorts of people, they can get a nimitta very easily. They can go right inside it because they're not afraid. I told this, I think, here to somebody in an interview in a retreat. I think this was a retreat down in the Genting Highlands. Somebody said they'd heard my teachings a lot, and I told them, you have to let go, and I gave them a simile that sometimes it's like driving along the highway, and I ask you to take your hands off the steering wheel, the feet off the pedals. Would you do that? That's what it's like, letting go to get into deep meditation. People think they will crash, but you don't. And this person had an even more extreme dream. They were in a car sitting next to me, going over a cliff. And at the end of the cliff, there was a road, but it turned to the right really quickly. And I was telling them, just let go. I'm going over a cliff. Let go. And they did let go in their dream. And they went right down the cliff, and they let go of the steering wheel, and the car turned the corner perfectly all by itself. See? It was one of those great dreams they had, which was brilliant. See, it was just telling them this is how it really happens in meditation. You don't need to be afraid. Have some trust that just let go and everything goes well. So all the anxiousness, sometimes we get into this habit of anxiousness. As soon as you're anxious, it just grabs onto you and you just get more and more anxious and anxious. Because one of the other reasons why fear comes to us is because we like to be afraid. I mean, how many of you were really afraid of the ghost story last night, but you love being in here? You like getting afraid. That's why you go to watch these movies which make you really afraid. Or I have obviously don't go to these amusement parks, but I've seen pictures of these rides which turn you upside down, or you go to these death drops, falling as if to your death and saved at the last moment. Or somebody, this is an article I read in a paper of like a zombie castle. Like the old ghost rides I used to have as a kid. You go in this and all these people dressed up as zombies come and catch you and try and touch you. And it's all dark and it's apparently really scary. And this journalist, this Australian who went to one of these zombie castles, said it was the most scariest thing she did, but it was really good value for money. Because people like that sort of stuff. That is why that sometimes we like to be afraid, because it gives us a feeling of purpose and existence, rather than just being still as if we don't exist at all. So eventually anxiety just totally vanishes when you meditate. You can let go so much, who cares what happens? Instead of being anxious, which is always thinking about what will go wrong in the future, we don't even think of the future at all. And if you do think of the future, you are, don't worry, you are hopey. That word which I invented. So hopey is the opposite of being anxious. Anxious is looking into the future, thinking of all the things which will go wrong. Hopey is looking into the future and thinking all of the things which might go right. That's called hopey. So my advice, don't worry, be hopey. So that's actually what happens. So what else should I do? You can meditate and just let go and welcome every emotion which ever comes into you. It comes, it goes, it will pass. Short of the writer of this Disney classic tune was a Buddhist. Don't spend your time looking around you for something you want that can't be found. When you find out, you can live without it and go along not thinking about it. And I'll tell you something true. The bare necessities of life will come to you. Was that the bare necessities? The bare necessities tune. How does that go? Anyone want to try it? Don't ask me to sing because I'm too compassionate to impose my singing on anybody. Anyway, that's pretty good. Don't spend your time looking around you for something you want that can't be found. Nimittas, jhanas, happiness, whatever. When you find out you can live without it and go along not thinking about it, then I'll tell you something true. The bare necessities of life, nimittas and jhanas, will come to you. So you don't go looking for it and it comes to you. Very wise, Mr. Disney. I collect all these weird stories. I like weird stories. Someone gave us a newspaper on Tuesday, and I was really, really, really disappointed because they'd taken out the comics. That's the only reason I read newspapers for the comics. And probably got Disney comics, but because I'm English, you know the Ungmo, they're always really eccentric. You know, we're the home of eccentrics over in England. And that's well known. And in England, they have a Walt Disney Society. The people who are addicted to Walt Disney characters and cartoons, they meet together and they discuss, you know, Goofy or Roadrunner or whoever else is there. And there were a couple of these. I think it was actually the president of the Walt Disney Society, to show how much he was addicted to this part of Western culture. He actually changed his name by deed poll to Mickey Mouse. And that was his name. On the passport, you see Mouse. First name, Mickey. He must have had great fun going into places like Singapore and the airport. What's your name, sir? Mickey Mouse. He must be interrogated, but that was true. That was his name. But in the society, you know, coincidence is happen. He met this girl who was also addicted. Yes! She had changed her name to Minnie Mouse. And the inevitable happened. They fell in love. And they got married. In a church in England. And this poor preacher, I really felt so sorry for him, had to say in public, will you, Mickey Mouse, marry this girl, Minnie Mouse? I don't know how any priest could ever say that without falling down laughing. And it happened. Mickey and Minnie Mouse married. Anyway, we're going to get on to this. There is a part of the grounds with the sign, monk's meditation area, no entry. Is it really forbidden to enter that area? If you enter that area, bad things will happen to you. The last person who entered that area never came out. Except much later. No, that's just like any monastery, you know, we get many visitors. And sometimes, it's okay, you know me, I know you. Sometimes people haven't got a clue what monks are. And sometimes you really think it's not Bodhinyana Monastery, but Bodhinyana Zoo. That's what you feel like as a monk. They come and just poke you and take a photograph of you. And just like in a zoo, they give you some food. And people come to see the daily feeding ceremony in Bodhinyana Zoo. And sometimes we get a new monk there, maybe from Sri Lanka, so all the Sri Lankans come and see, oh, that's a new animal in the zoo. It's what it feels like. So to get some privacy, we have this central area. Anyone can walk around the central area, which includes the main hall, the lakes, the kitchen, and get themselves a cup of tea. But where the monks hang out, no, please, stay away. Because, that's our area, where we can meditate. So that's the reason why, because the zoo stops there. But on Katina Day, and usually another day of the year, which is the rain day, you can go wherever you want and have a look around. Wisdom will come with meditation. How would we know? If you ask that question, you don't know. If you don't ask the question, then you are wise. I'll give a talk on insight tomorrow morning. If people are easily satisfied, wouldn't there be no technological advancement and economic growth? Yes, but there'd be no climate change. There'll be no Chernobyls and Fukushimas. There'll be no waste grounds. There'll be no people which are just struggling to get a fair share of the economic pie. There'll be no people starving. There'll be no people fighting wars. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if people were easily satisfied? If it means you wouldn't have to go to work and work so hard, how much do you need? Even like your house, your apartment, how many rooms? Even in Singapore, it's a very cramped country. How many rooms do you have in your house? How many rooms can you sleep in one time? So even there, there's small houses, but you can do smaller. If you want to see the smaller house, see my cave. And look at some of the houses here in Perth. They are monstrous houses. And I don't know why people, the only reason people do that is because everyone else has got a big house. And when you've got a big house, someone else wants a bigger one. And what do you need that for? Priya, your house is huge. There's only you and your mum in there. And your dogs, of course. But it's a big house you've got there. And it's because it's an average, good-looking house in Melbourne. But sometimes you think, wouldn't it be wonderful to downsize? To have a simple house, simple to look after. The only reason people have big houses is to impress others, that's all. You know that story, I don't know if I told it here yet. I think I probably did, about the woman in England who won the lottery. 42 million sterling. She sold her house 1 year later. She bought a big mansion with the lottery win. Bought a big mansion, sold it 1 year later because she said in that big house she could never find her children or her husband. It was such a huge house. The kids were in the west wing. The husband was in the south wing. Someone else was in the east wing and she was in the other wing. And they never saw each other, which is why it was breaking up the family. Big houses or mansions are bereft of love. Because you don't see each other. You don't meet each other. I know where I grew up, a very small apartment, because my father was very poor, sick most of his life. We were always sharing our rooms, always bumping in. You couldn't escape from anybody. So you didn't have any privacy, but my goodness, you learned how to love each other. There was no escape. You had to. And how many of you were in a house, with five or six siblings, all in the same room, sometimes in the same bed? And you had a wonderful time. And you loved each other to bits.
No.
It's the exception which proves the rule. But a lot of time people learn how to get on with each other because they've got no choice. And these days people just cannot get on with each other. So I think easily satisfied, if you look upon it, Yeah, there'd be no technological advancements and economic growth, but there'd be much more happiness and peace and less wars in the world. Are people who discover scientific breakthroughs and leaders who continue to improve the economic conditions of their people unhappy people unless they're striving to do better purely for the benefit of others? Does material progress necessarily result in spiritual decline? It does if it's just for the sake of material progress. How much do you really need? How many clothes do you need? How many shoes do you need? You've only got 2 feet. And so you can see it does create a lot of waste in our economy. It does use so many resources. And you know what's going to happen in this world soon. We're going to run out. Are we going to use all the energy up? And whatever we're using up is already creating problems with the environment. So there should be a balance. Material progress is okay, but it should not be at the expense of world happiness. So that's my idea. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please explain exactly how to do loving kindness to your pain, physical. Many people die young. Why is that? Sometimes it's because their karma runs out. Some people, they say that if you've been kind and caring, especially to people and animals, you've looked after them, nurses, doctors, vets or something, then you live a long life in the next life because you've helped other people live long lives. But if you've shortened people's lives, like being a butcher or a soldier or something, then because you've shortened other people's lives, the next life you have a short life. It's sort of like a karmic reason why people have short lives, why they die young. But how to do loving kindness to your pain? Is that loving kindness I was saying this morning to open the door of your heart to it? No, don't reject it. And when you... I always remember this, one of the stories again and again. When I was young, grew up in the suburb of Acton. You know, it's just where you grew up, but I was never realised that all the kids who went to school were mostly migrants or Afros. You know, there was only like a few sort of indigenous English like me. And it was a migrant suburb because it was very poor. I never realised that until later on, because that's what you grew up, that's what you know, you don't realise it's anything else. So it was a very poor neighbourhood, and so you used to spend a lot of your time just playing soccer in the streets. So whenever you, if ever you've played soccer or watched soccer, whenever you go for a tackle, you fall over. And I was always scraping, I always remember scraping the skin off my knees. I've always had scabs on my knees, you know, from scraping and falling over on the asphalt or the stone paving. And as soon as I did that, you know, 6, 7-year-old kid, you were crying, "Mummy, I've hurt, blood was coming down." You go to your mother, and my mother would just kneel down, and she would kiss it better, she said. "I'll kiss it better." And as soon as she did that, the pain always disappeared. And I then went off playing football again. Didn't even put a bandage on it, just kissed it better, and off I went. And I always remember that. You know, I didn't know anything about science at the time. It just happened, and I realize now that, you know, putting an open mouth with all those germs on an open wound, how on earth did that get better? It was just the kindness, the love. That's what took the pain away. And you may remember, you may have been in great pain or difficulty, and your mother or, you know, someone you love very much came to your bedside and stroked your hair when you were very young. And straight away with that tiny bit of kindness, you felt so much better. Maybe the pain disappeared. Especially the fear, and you went into a nice deep sleep. Kindness is one of the greatest anesthetics. It takes away the pain and the fear. That's why, if you can do the very same thing to pain in your body, literally kiss it better and be kind to it, it tends to vanish and disappear. Just like when I was a kid. Anyway. While I appreciate the constant and controllable indoor environment for meditation, I also like the idea of outdoor meditation close to nature. Please comment on indoor versus outdoor meditation. Appreciate any tips you may have for successful outdoor meditation. Always people who live in the cities say, "Oh, it's so nice to get close to nature." People who actually live close to nature, like us, we live in a forest, they really enjoy going into the city. Where there are no mosquitoes, there are no flies, there are no bugs on the floor, there are no bushfires, there's no... everything is so convenient. Why do you think people built cities? To escape from the dangers of nature, that's why. So sometimes it's only people who live in a city think, oh, it'd be so nice to go out into the forest and live into the forest. You try that. There's bugs everywhere. And if you haven't seen them yet, just go for a walk in our forest. You know, without, and already the flies are coming out. They go up your nose, up one nose, down the other nose. They're just interested, that's all. They want to explore. And it's hot. Sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold. It reminds me of that story of... It's in Opening the Door of Your Heart. Remember the story of the fish in the aquarium? And these two monks who were visiting a person's house, and one of them said, it's cruel, it's unfair for Buddhists to put fish in an aquarium. It's like putting them in a prison. What are those fish done? To be put in an aquarium in somebody's house. All they can do is swim this way and that way, and this way and that way. It's really boring. You try doing walking meditation in that room all day. Now you know what it feels like to be a fish in an aquarium. But the other monk said, no, you don't understand. Because fish in an aquarium, they are safe from so many dangers. In an aquarium in someone's house, they're safe from fishermen. You never find a person dropping a line into someone's aquarium. That's number one. Number two, they are protected from bigger fish. Because, you know, big fish eat small fish. But you never put big fish in small fish in the same aquarium. So they'd have no danger from being beaten up or eaten by big fish. Number three, it's got nice temperature. Because, you know, sometimes in nature it gets very cold, and actually in some places the streams freeze over. In other places it's a drought, there's not enough water at all. In an aquarium it's like being in an air-conditioned, climate-controlled room. And also in an aquarium you don't need to worry about food. You get takeaway, it's actually delivered to your door every day. And lastly, in an aquarium, fish get free healthcare. If anything goes wrong, they get one of these experts to come along and fix you up. So yeah, it's true that they lose many freedoms to be able to swim wherever they want, but they get many benefits as well. So it's like, you know, you lose some things by living in a city, but you gain many other things as well. You lose many things by staying in nature, but you also gain a sense of freedom as well. But that main simile was keeping precepts. If you keep your five precepts, you can't swim where you'd like to swim. You know, and so commit adultery or take alcohol, which, you know, you might like to do. But if you keep within those five precepts, you're free from so many dangers and difficulties and pain. So yeah, you're constricted like the fish in the tank, but you have a life free from danger. Anyway, there are two dead ponds in the garden. Suggests that we bring some life there by putting in some fishes. Let the lucky ones have the chance to enjoy jhana growth. There are fishes in the pond, but they're sitting in meditation, they're in jhana. They're so still that you can't see them. They're not dead, they're just meditating. Really sincere gratitude to you for your wonderful teachings. No words can really do justice to how I feel. So how have you written so much? Anyway, two questions. Yesterday when I was meditating, using the breath meditation, breathing in peace, breathing out, letting go, after a while, I really felt the peace. But, why do you write buts in the questions? The question was going so nicely and then, buts. But there was a strange tingling sensation at the top of the head that grew and grew in a straight line upwards, not sure what there is. Am I imagining things? No, you're just tingling, that's all. Let it happen and see what happens next. It usually just disappears. When you get deep meditation, you have some really interesting experiences. They're really weird. But I like weird experiences, because life is so boring, having the same old experience like you have in Singapore, day in, day out. Having some weird stuff like tingling going out of your head. Wow. Having like rays coming out of your ears. Isn't that cool? So any weird stuff, enjoy it, because otherwise you get so bored. So it's just nature. I really like this retreat. Nothing to change at all. Food, room, cushions, forest walks, everything is wonderful. There's no but. Amazing. So the question is this the only session open to Buddhist Fellowship Singapore members, or can I sign up for other retreats for the rest of the year? Thank you. And yeah, of course you can. The thing is, though, that the other retreats is so hard to get on. What was it, Daniel, the November retreat, when it was opened up, because we have a time, 6 p.m. or whatever time it was, it's opened up on the internet, and 150 people were on the, exactly the same time?
They got fully booked in 7 minutes.
7 minutes, but that took time, because about 150 people were online at the same time, trying to do all of the right things, and the ones which were slow just didn't get on. So that'd be very quick. So if you want to get on the retreat, please train. Train on the computer to be really fast, and then maybe you can get on. So the BF retreat is much easier for you to get on, simply because, you know, there's not that many people go on this retreat. It's just for the BF, no one else. Well, you know, get a few other people get in, but mostly for the Buddhist Fellowship. So, you know, it's your retreat, so it's much easier. But of course, you're most welcome to try for the other ones. Mark, Heath, Bamali, D. Cut, Check, Shirley. What's this one here? You bamboozled me, that's the deepest question I've ever had. Wow. Does anyone know what I mean? I think someone got a note for someone they just dropped in the box by mistake. What does this mean? That is the most profound question I've ever got. Rubbish. That's Mark, Shirley,
and
Pamari. Anyway, dear Bhante, please explain awareness and mindfulness. I have a problem explaining the meaning of mindfulness to others. Thank you. Again, I like the term mindfulness being in the present moment and being silent. If you're not in the present moment, if you're off into the future or the past, literally you're not here, you're not aware, you're not in this moment, you're in fantasy land, dreamland. I've been saying to a lot of people, even the past is fantasy. Because what you think happened is not what happened. You're choosing, picking, and deleting things which you don't like. So it is just the same as making up some dream or fantasy realm. What you think happened is not what happened. Just like the future, you know, what you imagine it to be hardly ever happens. So that's why it's a total waste of time. So first of all, you have to be in the present moment. And instead of talking at life, you're actually being here. And this is actually, I mentioned that Looney cartoon on the first day about these two people watching a TV set of a sunset, and just outside the window was a real sunset. Thinking is like looking at the words. Mindfulness is looking at the sunset without any words. That's what awareness is. That's what mindfulness is. So the two things are the same. Dear Your Roundness, what have you been asked to do during the 7 days by the person who had to win the auction? Yes, that was actually raising funds for our nuns' monastery, trying all different ways to squeeze the lemon. And so we're having all these auctions, because the first fundraiser we did, I think it was in Hong Kong, they took my meditation cushion. I've been sitting on that for years. It was just really nice and soft and warm. It was just, just molded to my bottom, just nice. And they went and auctioned it in Hong Kong. The problem was, I think they got about, was it 30,000 or 40,000 or 50,000 Australian dollars? Huge amount. And what that meant is now, when I leave my cave, I have to put my meditation cushion in a safe. And get it insured. It's worth too much. Not quite, I'm only joking. But then we had all these other auctions, and this one lady was going into my cave, I'll take that, I'll take that. And all my stuff was gone missing. And one weekend, this is absolutely a true story, one weekend I was teaching over in Perth, and this lady went into my cave, see what else we can auction of Ajahn Brahm, and she took my blanket. And when I came back, I was so tired I didn't realize it was gone. In the middle of the night, I woke up, it was so cold. Where's my blanket? You're gone. You've been auctioned. So I got paranoid about that woman. So, but what we did there, they're auctioning all this stuff, so why not everything? My body, my mind doesn't belong to me. My robe, that went too. So why not auction me? Same as my robe, my cushion, doesn't belong to me. So I might as well auction it. So I auctioned me to the highest bidder, Ajahn Brahm for sale. And finally it was auctioned, an Indonesian man got me. And the whole deal was, you can take Ajahn Brahm for 7 days, do whatever you want, but you must return him in the same condition you got him. So this Indonesian guy, he's organized a tour with his friends to Bhutan. So he's taken me to Bhutan for 7 days. Now you may like that, but look, quite honestly, that I don't like traveling around and touring around. What's the point? If you want to see a mountain, look, we've got a hill here. What's the difference? If you want to see a waterfall, want to see Niagara Falls or Victoria Falls, if you want to see a waterfall, turn on the shower. This waterfall is the same. Great Wall of China. Look at that. We've got a wall at our monastery. That's big enough. Why do you want to go to this place for? Rainforest. It rains here. You've got a forest. The same thing. I don't know why people want travelling all over the world. It's all here. So basically, I'm going to probably get bored stiff. Just, here we go. Another mountain. Yeah, seen them before. What's the big deal? But anyway, it's not to raise funds. I've made my promise, and so I keep my promises. So I'll be going to Bhutan for 7 days. Sheena 94510. Is it helpful to find a purpose in life to help give us meaning and joy in life and help us abandon defilements? Yeah, purpose in life is okay, but as long as it's the right purpose and it's a purpose which is achievable. So I remember my purpose in life, one of the purposes in life I got when I went on a retreat with another monk. And during the interview period, I was just sitting down being the attendant and getting really bored because, you all ask the same questions again and again and again. And if anyone asked me, Ajahn Brahm, why do you keep telling the same stories and the same jokes? It is because you keep asking the same questions. So anyway, I was just getting bored. And then this woman came in to the interview room. And instead of asking a question on meditation about her family or the kids or her health or the economy and blah, 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 she said, I've come in here to say thank you for saving my life. And it was said with such sincerity. I just woke up. Hey, this is interesting. What's gone on? And the story was, this monk was giving a retreat in the fishing village of Oban in northwest Scotland, which is a very peaceful, beautiful, quiet town. And he'd done this retreat the year before when this woman had come and they were keeping 8 precepts. And it wasn't explained very well to this girl. She thought you couldn't have any drugs at all. And ever since she was a young teenager, she had some little problem, and the doctor had prescribed Valium, and she'd become addicted to Valium. And when she went on this retreat, she heard 8 precepts, no alcohol or drugs. She said, oh God, I've got to give up my Valium. And so she did. It was tough for her, but because it was such a peaceful place, so beautiful, and hardly any stress at all, she managed the 9 days. Now of course, from those experiences, I would say, no, if you've got antipsychotic drugs, please take them. Otherwise, we get people running around naked in Jhana Grove, banging on doors with chainsaws. Please take your antipsychotics or whatever else you're taking. But she never took her Valium for 9 days. And after 9 days, she realized it was a mistake. She could have taken that, but she'd done 9 days. She thought, why not keep on going without the Valium? And the problem was for her, she had to take a bus from Oban to Glasgow and then transfer to the train station to get home. And if ever you've been to a big, busy train station like Changi Airport, there's so many people rushing this way and that way. It's a high-stress environment. And she said she almost totally lost it and literally went into psychosis from the effects of not taking the Valium. But she held herself together just, with the advice of, this too will pass, open the door of your heart, just be kind to the monster. She managed to get on the train and get home. And when she got home, she said she spent the next month, this is just the way she described it, the next month just sitting in an armchair, not able to do anything. Just allowing the effect of those drugs to come out of her system, which they did. And she said it was amazing. It was like for years she was living in a cloud, in a mist. She couldn't feel very much, even seeing things, everything was dull. Taste, there was hardly any taste in the food which she ate. And now she was totally free. It's like before she was dead, and now she's been given her life back because of the addiction to that sort of drug. And so he said, thank you for giving me those teachings. You saved my life. When I heard that, I thought, wow, that's my purpose in life as a monk. To get someone, just one person, to come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for saving my life, and mean it. And of course, when that first happened, I thought, yep, that's it, I've had my purpose in life now. I can relax. And you know me, hundreds of people have now said that, and they really meant it. Imagine what that does to you. With the joy and happiness you get when you really have made a huge difference to people's lives. Wow, that just gives so much happiness inside. Now you know your purpose in life. Is it useful to have a goal? That's right, goal to aspire to, yeah. Again, isn't it amazing? Because these questions, they always come up in pairs, totally different handwriting. You must be like at school cheating. See what someone else wrote and write the same. Dear Ajahn, indeed the most scary stories I heard from you is a no-driver bus, not these ghost stories. How can we see the driver's seat through stillness or jhana, despite very scary, super scary? I hope one day I have the guts to see by myself. Yeah, no, those are the anatta, the non-self similes. And I always remember going to Singapore to the BF, for a couple of years I would talk about always the same type of stories. Open the door of your heart, the 2 bad bricks in the wall, the Emperor's 3 questions. People love those ones. But there was one day I was going to a talk, in Singapore. I think, who was the president now, the lawyer? Soon Han, yeah. Soon Han asked me, just before I was going to give the talk, he said, Ajahn Brahm, can't you give a deep talk for once? A really deep talk like you give to the monks. I said, okay, I'll give a deep talk if you want. So I gave this talk on anatta, non-self, including the driverless bus. There's no one there. And the thing you call the will does not belong to you at all. It's a total illusion. You think you're in control. It's such a powerful talk. The following morning when he picked me up to take me to the airport, he really scolded me. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, don't ever do that again." I was so afraid, I didn't sleep a wink all night. I was so afraid. It was really true. Sometimes you've got to be ready for deep talks like that, otherwise it just totally blows your mind. And he understood it enough to say most of the things which he assumed he was were totally false. And that blew him away, and he couldn't sleep all night. He was so scared. So that's actually, you say that's very perceptive. But what happens is the jhanas, the deep meditations, are so happy and so blissful. Yeah, you are scared, but it's just too much fun. You know, it's a joy which overpowers fear. It's just, you know, you meditate, it's getting so much fun. Yeah, you're losing a lot of stuff, and, you know, normally you would not be able to let go that much, but it's so much fun, you just keep on going deeper into the joy and the bliss. Even though much of what you think you are and own disappears, you can't stop yourself. You just get drawn into the bliss. It's only afterwards you realize, my God, what happened? But you enjoyed every moment of it. It is the piti sukha, the joy, the happiness, the bliss, the ecstasy. That is what overpowers all fear. Dear Ajahn, after a great meditation yesterday, I had a most glorious dream just before waking up. A departed loved one whom I had not thought about for a while was coming to spend a day with me in the best of conditions. It was unexpected, and I was, oh, so happy and excited. This contrasts with the many unpleasant dreams I had the previous 3 nights, when another departed loved one whom I've been thinking about disappears the moment I notice her presence, leaving me with regret and longing. On those days, my meditation got nowhere. Any connection, which is chicken, which is egg? And it's very true that, you know, what you dream about is what you take into sleep with you. So, you know, if you go into sleep just worrying about something, that's what you'll dream about. Which is one of the reasons why the Buddha said, at the very least, before you go to sleep, do a bit of loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. May I be happy and well. May I have beautiful dreams. And that bit of loving kindness actually works. You have a very soft and beautiful mind, you have soft and beautiful dreams. But if you really go to bed thinking, why does that person keep banging the door? Why do they keep banging the door? And then you have all these dreams about banging. It's just what you're taking to sleep with this. So you had a very good meditation. And of course, good meditations happen if you have nice dreams afterwards. So that's why sometimes the people like doing the counting meditation before they go to sleep, because they're thinking about numbers before they go to sleep. So during the sleep they may see. No, I'm only joking. Don't try and get lottery numbers in your sleep. What makes a stream winner? That's when you've seen there's nobody in here. It just changes your whole way of looking at life. May I ask about near-death experiences and Anita Morjani's book? Can one achieve the same insights, realization that she had, reconnections that she made with departed loved ones through meditation? What was the reason for her complete healing? You get much more insight and understanding through the meditation. You can go much deeper than she went and have a greater understanding. It's just the near-death experiences are sometimes more common. You know, because of the advances of modern medicine, the more people actually survive these things than they never did before. So there's more people get those experiences, but they're totally involuntary and unrepeatable. But in meditation, you can keep on repeating as often as you want. So you get more understanding, more experience, and therefore more insight from them. That's why the near-death experience, we mention these to give you an understanding that yes, these things are possible, this is what it's like. It inspires you and gives you a taste of what it's like in deep meditation. But you know, most people only have a near-death experience once, and the next time it's a real thing. But meditation, you can keep on doing that long, long times and still be alive. And meditation goes much deeper, so it is a much better one. Doing it through meditation. The last question. One of the 5 precepts, no drinking of alcohol, is social drinking allowed for a Buddhist practitioner? A glass of beer or champagne in a party? Well, you know, you've got to be sort of moderate. So a little bit of drinking is okay. And a little bit of adultery is okay. A little bit of murder is okay. As long as it's only social murder. Of course it's not okay. So, if you're in a social party, you know, if you really want to avoid having beer, you can have a glass of beer, but just hold it in your hand and don't drink it. As long as you're holding one there, then no one fills it up. That's one way of doing it. But like my friend who was keeping the five-piece, some of these Angmos are really, really smart, much smarter than me sometimes. Actually, I'm an Angmo, aren't I? But anyway, this person, he was keeping the five precepts, he'd just taken them, and he went to a social party. And when his friend said, have a drink, he said, no, I can't have a drink anymore, I'm a Buddhist now. And his friend said, are you a Buddhist? I know about Buddhism. Buddhism is all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a and have a drink. And it didn't work. So he said he had to have a drink and letting go. But then he had another scheme. He said he managed to solve the problem because next party he went to, someone offered him a drink and he refused, saying, I can't drink alcohol because of doctor's orders. And people respect that. They don't want to kill the guy or make him sick. So they have some orange juice or Coca-Cola or something, or water. So he got out of having to take alcohol because he told people doctor's orders. And when he told me that story, just like many of you, if you haven't heard this before, I said, aren't you keeping one precept by breaking another? No, you're lying. There's nothing wrong with you. You're perfectly healthy. And that's where he reminded me that in the sutras, very often the Buddha compared himself to a doctor. So my friend said it was the doctor's orders. Dr. Buddha's orders. And therefore he got away with drinking. And these days you don't have to have social drinks. People actually respect you, you know, if you decide not to drink. The last story was of a friend, a business guy over in Sydney. Great story. He had a food business, and he was trying to get this contract with this business in Taiwan. It's supposed to be Buddhist business, okay, but some of these businesses are not Buddhist at all, just on the surface. They go to the temple, they shake the joss sticks, and that's about as far as they go. And after many emails, phone calls, the Taiwanese business said, we're going to send a delegation over to Sydney to sign the contract. It's going to be worth a lot of money, quite a few million dollars. So they came, they discussed the final details, and they said, okay, we're ready to sign. But not now. We'll sign later on this evening, after you have supplied us with, please excuse me, prostitutes each, and taken us to a nightclub and pay for all the beer and the other alcohol. And this guy, he said, but I'm a Buddhist. I have a wife. I don't want a prostitute, and I'm not going to get you prostitutes either. And I don't drink alcohol. And the business people from Taiwan said, look, this is what we want. If you don't give it to us, there's no contract. And he had his choice, you know, just give in just for one night and get this multi-million dollar contract for his own company, or keep his precepts and keep the trust of his wife. And I was so proud of him. He said, no contract. I prefer to keep my precepts. I prefer my wife. And so the business people said, right, okay, no contract. And he went home. He was so disappointed because, you know, he needs the money. You know, businesses need those contracts. He employs many people, and that makes things very difficult, not winning the contract, especially when you get so close. And he was at home that night, feeling a bit down. Late at night, he got a telephone call from those businessmen. And they said, "We've been discussing you and thinking about this. We'd rather do business with someone who doesn't cheat on his wife. Because if someone cheats on his wife, they'll probably cheat on us too. We prefer someone who's virtuous and doesn't take alcohol. So because of your high standards, we want to come to your house if you're still up to sign the contract." And the contract was signed. Because it doesn't make sense. If you're running a company, who would you like to do business with? Someone who cheats on their wife? Someone who doesn't mind getting drunk and spilling all the secrets of the business? Who would you rather do business with? It was a wonderful true story of how he got that contract, kept his precepts, because it makes so much sense. So social drinking, you don't need to do the social drinking. In fact, if you keep sober, when all the other people in the other businesses or the people in your office, in your department, in your company, after they've taken a few drinks, it's amazing how many secrets they spill. And you're sober enough to remember it all. So you don't need to have social drinks. Not these days anyway, because it's quite acceptable to be sober. So there we go, those are the questions tonight. So thank you all for listening. There'll be some more questions tomorrow. And I did do really well. No ghost stories, no food. Oops, I said them again. Sadhu. Sadhu.